All right, hello, I'm Corey. I'm going to talk about, reducing opioid overdose by changing law and policy. And actually, I can't claim that these laws and policies reduce opioid overdose, but we hope they do, and I can tell you why I think they might. I also have no disclosures, financial or otherwise. So here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to talk about some legal and regulatory barriers to naloxone access, and I'm going to describe interventions to reduce fatal opioid overdose via increased access to naloxone. I call these naloxone access laws, increased access to emergency responders. I call these Good Samaritan laws. I'm going to talk a little bit about some other, we call promising legal and regulatory strategies, and if you're wondering what naloxone is, just wait a slide. As most of the folks in this room know, fatal opioid overdose is an epidemic in the United States. Depending on where your numbers come from, we're talking 15, 16,000 people a year in the United States dying of opioid overdose, largely prescription drug overdose. Prescription opioid overdose now kills more people in the United States than heroin and cocaine combined, and is up about 300%, give or take, in the last decade. So we really are talking about an epidemic. You know, the interesting and frustrating thing about the epidemic is that it's largely preventable. Opioid overdose is almost always preventable before it turns into fatal opioid overdose if the proper treatment is administered in time. It takes a long period of time in general for someone to die of an opioid overdose. Opioid overdose kills by depressing respiration. The process, it can happen quickly, but it typically takes hours. And there is this drug called naloxone. Typically it's the hydrochloride form, so naloxone hydrochloride, brand name Narcan, that effectively and relatively safely reverses opioid overdose. I'm going to come back to that. But the point here is that law and regulation act as a barrier to access to this drug, and that if we want to increase access to that drug, we should look to amending the laws and regulations that are keeping that drug from being in the hands of people who are in the right place at the right time to use it. So what is this thing? What is this naloxone? I'm going to call it by its brand name, Narcan, just because it rolls off the tongue a little easier. So Narcan is a prescription drug. It's not a controlled substance. It's an opioid antagonist. It has high affinity for opioid receptors, particularly the mu receptor in the brain. You have an opioid in the receptor, Narcan just comes along and knocks it out. If the person is habituated to opioids, it'll actually precipitate withdrawal. It just removes the opioid from the receptor, reverses the respiratory depression or whatever other negative things that, or positive things for that matter, that the opioid might be doing. It has no abuse potential. It does absolutely nothing except acts as a strong antagonist for opioids. You can't get high off it. If the person has no opioids on board and you administer the drug, it does absolutely nothing. It has a very good risk profile. No drug is completely safe, but Narcan is safer than most because of its mechanism of action. It's widely used in the pre-hospital setting. It's on every advanced life support ambulance in the country. Every paramedic is trained in its use and you know, does use it when necessary. It's widely used in the hospital environment as well. The problem is, as I said, it's often not available when and where it's needed, which is in people's homes and other places where overdose actually occurs. You know, one of the ways to get it there is to have it prescribed by people's primary care physician or other provider so that they can have it on hand. So there are a couple of mainly regulatory barriers that keep that from happening in general. big one is prescriber concerns about civil and professional liability. Physicians and providers in general are a little bit lawsuit averse, and they have a coterie of attorneys who are always telling them about the risks they might be putting themselves in if they do things that seem a little bit outside the mainstream. Now, we know, because there's been empirical research done, that there is very little actual risk. My colleague and former mentor, Scott Burris, actually went looking through the case law to see if he could find any examples of any provider ever losing a lawsuit because of they prescribed Narcan, and he was looking actually particularly at heroin users, because when we did the research, that was the big risk group. Not only couldn't he find anybody who had ever lost such a suit, he could find no record of anybody ever being sued, with that being the cause of action. So, you know, we can't say there's no risk. We can say the risk is low. However, we also know through other empirical research that providers are very worried about this possibly non-existent risk. And when you ask them, why don't you do this, they say, we might get sued, and we don't want to get sued. So it is a real barrier in the sense that it affects practice. There's also the problem that, you know, there aren't that many doctors around. Again, it varies by state. In a lot of states, you don't necessarily need a physician to issue the prescription, but providers in general, prescribers in general, are in short supply, particularly if you don't have, if you're uninsured or underinsured. So you have that lack of access to a prescriber problem. You know, we have this other issue whereby if you are suffering an overdose in your home and you actually do call 911. In a lot of jurisdictions, particularly but not only more rural areas, the people who show up may not have the drug on them to administer to you. In urban areas, police are almost always the first on scene to a drug-related medical call. They're routinely dispatched, and again, varies by jurisdiction. But even in a place where EMS comes, in all but 8 or 9 states, depending on how you count, basic level EMTs, which are the most numerous form of EMTs, aren't actually permitted to administer the drug. So you have somebody who can come out, who is, you know, looks, you know, is the ambulance guy, can load you in the ambulance, but all he can do is take you to the hospital. He can't actually administer the drug via state regulation or sub-regulatory policy. There's also criminal concerns, whereby we have, you know, a lot of common sense and now good empirical evidence. The people who are present when an overdose occurs don't make that phone call. They don't call 911 because they're worried. And, you know, this isn't limited to heroin users. It happens with prescription opioid users as well. They're worried about, you know, I might get arrested. You know, what if, you know, they might not know, do I have a domestic violence order against me? Do I have some sort of outstanding criminal problem? It keeps people, obviously not everybody, but it keeps people from calling 911. And there's also this sort of related issue where people may not carry the drug because they're worried that if they use it, they might somehow get in trouble for that, or they might get in trouble for carrying it. Had a little picture of it there, and it's a vial, you know, and if your average law enforcement officer finds someone with a clear vial and who has some of the hallmarks of being an illicit drug user, they're not going to test the drug first to see if it's actually a controlled substance. They're going to arrest you and run you through the system. If it turns out that, well, it's just Narcan, they'll let you go later, but by that time you spent some time in jail. So we now have, these are all in the area of things that we suspected were barriers, but we now know are barriers because people have gone out and done the research on it. Okay, so all of those legal and regulatory barriers are unintended consequences of attempts to address other problems, right? But, you know, they have this severe side effect that they inhibit access to this drug that we know can save lives. So what can we do? Well, we can change those laws. We can change those laws to make it easier for people to access the drug. Like I said, you know, it's pretty straightforward. We just tweak the law a little bit to address those barriers. So we want to get rid of possible civil and criminal liability for prescribers, mainly so that we can tell them, look, there's no possibility you can be sued. Some states have endorsed what's called third-party prescription and use of standing orders. So that gets rid of the problem whereby you need the prescriber and the patient in the same room at the same time. So the prescriber can examine the patient and say, yes, you're someone who may be at risk of opioid overdose. I'm going to write you this prescription. That's the way normal medicine works, and in general, it's a good idea. But in this particular instance, it's a barrier to access. So we want to do what we can to remove that barrier. So by October 15th of last year, 8 states had passed laws doing some version of those 3 things. By November 1st of this year, that number had increased to 17. Okay, so there's been a big change. Here you can see over time the purple bar is the total number, the orange bar is the number of states that have passed laws in that year. So you can see there's just been this explosion of states recently that have done this. And because we're in the law section, I put up some sample language that I won't read to you, but I would say that the point I would make here is that as laws go, these are very straightforward. It's not complicated. You can do this very easily. So this law just permits third-party prescription and provides immunity to a prescriber who prescribes the drug. It's very straightforward. And I won't even read this one. Just trust me when I tell you it does essentially the same thing for the administrator. So on the Good Samaritan side, you want to do, you want to provide some level of immunity to people who call 911 in good faith to report a drug overdose to someone emergency responders, because that's what we want people to do. We don't want people to be afraid of making that phone call. So as of October 15th of last year, you had 10 states that had passed what we would call these overdose Good Samaritan laws. By earlier this week, there were 14, and the District of Columbia. You can see the same sort of progression there, that really in 2010 these bills took off. In some states, I would say they're combination bills where it's a combined naloxone access Good Sam bills. Some states just have a naloxone access bill. Some states just have Good Sam bills. There's no reason you can't run them together, and that is sort of the trend, but you don't need to. And here is an example of a Good Samaritan bill. They all follow this general format. If you're acting in good faith and you call 911 to report that there's an overdose victim, you have some criminal immunity. Some states it's relatively broad. Vermont has a broad immunity. It provides immunity from any violation of the Controlled Substances Act. Most of them are a little more circumscribed. It's something like simple possession of small amounts of drugs and drug paraphernalia. Some places, like the District of Columbia, extend it to other things, which I think is actually a good innovation, and it just wasn't on the radar with the earlier laws. Provide protection from things like violations of probation and parole, which is another thing that people, worried about calling 911 if they're on probation or parole, even if they're not, don't want to get taken in again. And so here's the map of the United States. You can see what states have done what. The green states are states that have only Narcan bills. The light blue are Good Sam bills only. And the sort of combination color are states that have passed both, and you can see it's a good cross-section. You have sort of the usual suspects of New York and California, but you've also got your Floridas and your Carolinas and your Oklahomas in there. So it's not a partisan type thing. So let's end by saying that these changes are popular. They've happened quickly. Once the ball started rolling, it went along quickly. It's really picking up speed. There's very little organized opposition to these bills. People were worried or suspected that groups such as law enforcement might come out against them, but we haven't seen that. In fact, in a number of states, including my state of North Carolina, the State Sheriff's Association was a strong supporter of the bill. Law enforcement folks get these things, including the Good Samaritan Good Samaritan bills. Like I said, we don't have outcome evaluations of these laws. We can't say that they're saving lives, but we do have, in Washington State, for example, they went out and asked people who use drugs, are you more likely to call 911 now? And people say yes, so we have self-reports that the behavior changes. Same with police. You go out and ask police and say, well, you can no longer arrest people. Are you going to keep hassling them now that the bill is in place? And overwhelmingly, police say, no, that's not what we're here for. That's not what we do. We want people to be healthy and happy as well. Of course, there are problems with implementation. You can pass a bill, but if nobody knows about it, it's not going to have any effect. Has been a little bit of movement on the first responder question. Effective November 1st of this year, Oklahoma, a bill went into effect in Oklahoma that permits basic EMTs as well as police and firefighters to be trained and to carry Narcan. There's a pilot bill in Ohio and some other states. Massachusetts and in New York, kind of the big ones, have done it through sort of just sub-regulatory means. So there's action there as well. So that's all I got. So we think these laws will work. They're obviously not magic bullets. This is part of a whole big package of legal and regulatory and policy changes that can be put in place and are being put in place to address the opioid overdose epidemic, but since they can happen relatively quickly, it seems like we should try to move forward with them. Obviously, we want to evaluate them and see whether and how well they work. Any questions? All right, so the first hand over there. Yeah, no, that's a great question. No, these are coming to be pitched as just sort of tort reform measures. So the laws, the Narcan access laws providing immunity to prescribers, no, you don't need to opt in or anything like that. They're just tweaks to the code. Well, yes. I'm not medically trained, but I talk to a lot of folks who are. I mean, I think there are a couple different questions there. I mean, so I've talked to folks who are working on bills, and that's one of the questions, should we require it? And one of the reasons that they often decide not to require it is just because of the perceived burden. But, again, there's no evidence that it actually is a burden. So myself and some others, including emergency medicine people, actually have a manuscript under review where we look at states, emergency EMT, EMS characteristics, right? So we look to see which levels of EMTs are permitted to administer the drug. We also look at the protocol. Is there a statewide protocol that tells you how much to give and what dose to give or not, and if so, what it is? And I think one of the interesting findings from that paper is that the protocols are all over the map, okay? So there's this question about whether you actually need a protocol. And I think good physicians and good paramedics will know that you need a starting point, but then you titrate to effect. Right, but some of these protocols start out with, say, a 2 milligram bolus of Narcan, okay, well, that's going to, you're going to get really agitated if you are under heavy opioid sedation, and suddenly, because like I said, the drug knocks the opioids right out of the receptors, so you're like this, and then boom, you're in precipitated withdrawal. So I guess it's a long way of saying, I think that that might be a protocol issue. You know, you don't need somebody to come awake like that. You just need to give them enough of the drug so that they no longer have severe respiratory depression. Because, you know, your pre-hospital emergency care, you're transporting that person, you know. You're transporting that person to the hospital, right? So you don't need to do everything there. Your job is to stabilize and transport. So, again, there's no empirical evidence for that. But that would be my response, is that maybe you have a protocol issue. You know, if you're... EMTs are giving the person enough that they're waking up and punching you in the face, you're probably giving them too much. Do we want to take more?
No,
we
go ahead.
Okay.
You mentioned that you had quite a bit of cooperation with law enforcement. I'm actually from an officer of policy in Idaho. So we've kind of introduced, we're going to probably run legislation around this session. But we have not had that degree of cooperation. In fact, it's been quite the opposite. They've been adamantly, this is ridiculous, why are you even considering asking us to do this? And can you kind of tell me how you built that story?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, again, like every, you know, if you know one state, you know one state, right? But, I mean, so I can speak to the two states that I'm actually most familiar with are my state of North Carolina and Florida. Florida is one of those states that has a Good Samaritan bill, not a Narcan bill. And that bill was actually pushed by a deputy in the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department. And he is he's a detective, and he's the in the homicide division. And he just, you know, kept processing a lot of dead drug users, and just kind of was like, we got to do something. So that kind of happened organically. I mean, it wasn't his bill, but he was a big supporter of it. And it just came from that place of like, what we're doing isn't working. And, you know, we need to figure out how to do it. I mean, in my state of North Carolina, it was, you know, there was a coalition of people who wanted to run the bills, and they just started out, you know, the year before the bill was to be introduced, having discussions with, in North Carolina, the big law enforcement group is the Sheriff's Association. So meeting with their legislative liaison, explaining the bill, meeting with the hospital association, explaining what was going on. So that by the time the bill was introduced, everybody knew it was coming and most of the concerns had already been addressed. And I mean, I would stress that, you know, most of the bills, I think from a public health standpoint, aren't actually that great because they're very restrictive. You know, law enforcement can still make arrests for a vast, vast number of things, and you know, a good cop can always find something to arrest somebody for if they really want to. You know, it's just, you know, most of these bills just protect for low level possessory offenses. So it could just be, I'm not saying that you're not doing a good job or something like that, but it could be that just, you know, and I think there's the knee jerk reaction, right? Why are we giving people a get-out-of-jail-free card? But the experience, I think, of the states has been that once law enforcement really understands what the bills do and what the goals are, that opposition kind of fades away. Not always and not everywhere, but...
You should tell him to contact
you. Oh, yeah, and you can obviously drop me a line and I can put you in touch with these folks.
I will.
Thanks.
All right, thank you.